Let's resume the meeting then, if we could. The next agenda item is number 2007-2008, number 78, severance tax, which is before us on a motion for rehearing. The time is 11:25 a.m. Mr. Gessler, I believe this is your motion for rehearing. If you'd like to introduce yourself, please, and tell us what you'd like for us to know about the motion for rehearing. We do have the benefit of the motion.
Thank you. My name is Scott Gessler, and I represent Mr. Dempsey, who filed the motion for rehearing. If I may make a suggestion to the board to expedite the process, I think many of these issues we've discussed. If I may just proceed in a sequence, I think it'll help out. With respect to the fiscal note, despite our efforts, we are going to be withdrawing that for this particular item, the fiscal challenge with respect to the size of the tax increase. Okay. The others will remain, and if I may just go directly to the single subject, the board has considered this multiple times, this exact same issue, and in fact considered it earlier today with respect to number 88. So I'll simply make a brief statement for the record here. The issue in number 88, I think, placed the separate subject argument in starker relief. It basically showed a single revenue stream with multiple spending mandates. That one had quite a few. This one still has more than one, we would argue, so it still violates the single subject. It basically provides money to the current, I guess, stakeholders, the current recipients, and then also adds another one, in this instance, the higher education subject. And we'd argue that that is part of, that's part of log rolling, coalition building and log rolling, the same. And that it contains two separate subjects for that. I won't go into it in detail, only because the board has heard these arguments multiple times.
And we can
I
consider
have a sense
the,
of exactly where yeah. the board's going to come out on this particular issue.
And I think it's fine for us to consider the prior discussion incorporated into this motion for rehearing. I think
okay.
that's fine. I appreciate the simplifying of the discussion today.
Thank you. I'd like to go to and next priority to dispose of these arguments as possible. Item number 3 with respect to the petition for the misleading, inaccurate, and incomplete title. Item number 3 is the fact that the title fails to identify the percentages of the tax revenue devoted to each one of the new purposes. We've had this discussion before the board on this exact same issue with respect to a prior severance tax initiative. And again, I know the board declined to change the title based on this, but I would simply state again that these ballots do two critical things. They impose taxes. Yes, I do like the word impose, but they impose taxes and take money from certain people, and they give money to other people. And the manner in which they give that additional money is critical information, and particularly when it's going to what we consider two separate subjects, two separate purposes, that will have an impact on how people view this and may impact how they vote on it as well. So for that reason, we think that the title is incomplete. It doesn't contain those people. And then with that, I think the only new issue that the board has not heard has to do with item number 2 with respect to the misleading title. Essentially, the initiative adds a new section. That new section is titled 39-35-105, subsection 3, which refers to, in it, subsection 1 and subsection 1C of 39-39-105. 39-39-105, subsection 1 and subsection 1C simply do not exist. Currently, there is no statute 39-39-105. And so when this particular 39-39-105-3 refers to other portions of it, those other portions simply don't exist. as a result, the for the colloquially known the debrucing provisions of this are not in effect, and for that reason, the title is.
Let me ask you about that particular one. It looks like Section 4 of the measure says that 39-29-105 is amended by the addition of a new subsection, and then it proceeds to lay out new subsection 3, but it then says 39-39-105, which I am guessing is probably a typographical error.
And it may be that. I'm sure the proponents will speak to that issue. I guess what I'm grounding my analysis in is the plain language of 39-39-105, which refers to paragraph C of subsection 1 of this section. So referentially, within 39-39-105, it refers to 39-39-105. It doesn't refer to a 39-29-105, even though, based on the language of this initiative, 39-39-105 should be placed, apparently, within 39-29-105. So I do understand that disparity, and that's why the analysis on this protest here is based upon the plain language within 39-39-105, because it refers to this section.
But if it was labeled there 39-29-105, you'd have no objection to it?
That's correct.
Okay.
And well, I should say wouldn't have this objection.
Right. No objection. Right. Exactly. I understand.
And Mr. Gessler, you know that, I mean, the board has some limited authority to allow technical corrections to the language of the measures at the request of proponents. Now, would you object if the proponents were to ask for a correction to the section number? Would you object to that?
Yes, I would. And my understanding is that the authority to make those corrections exists prior to substantive discussion about the titles. And once that discussion begins, the board has to. My understanding is that that's the way the board has operated in the past, based on his on this, that the ability to make these technical corrections is highly limited. Generally, only at the start of the discussion, before proponents and opponents have had an opportunity to weigh in on that.
And I think you're correct in that the one case that I'm aware of where the court addressed that issue of the board allowing a technical correction, the language from the case, and I don't seem to have the year in front of me, but it's a casino gaming measure 649 P second 303. The language from the court did say, or did refer to, allowing a correction when it's made at the beginning of a hearing on the title submission clause and summary. However, I know that we have sometimes allowed technical corrections when they're discovered later in the discussions, I think probably even on a motion for rehearing. And I guess I'm wondering how strictly we should apply that language. Is there some reason, some legal or policy reason why, for example, are people disadvantaged? I mean, if it truly is a typographical, and I'm assuming for the moment that it may be, but in the case where there's a true, on its face, typographical error, is anyone disadvantaged by a correction other than at the very beginning of the discussion about the titles?
Well, I think there are disadvantages as far as the way this is structured and put together. And I would also argue that the particular analysis with respect to the disadvantage doesn't hold weight with respect to other, you know, other aspects of this. Generally, strict adherence is required to the memorandum from Legislative Legal Services and following that and coming before the board. So. I guess I would argue that sort of the disadvantage or almost a standing argument is not the proper viewpoint, but rather the adherence to the necessary formalities on this.
Well, I mean, there's no provision for the board allowing technical corrections at all, I don't think. I mean, this is something that I can recall after the language has been submitted to the Secretary of State. I don't recall anything that allows the board to accept technical corrections. I mean, except that the court has said that could be done. So I'm just trying to infer how the court would react if they were presented with a slightly different case where the typographical error was caught later in the consideration of a measure. And would there be any reason for the court to come out any differently if it's truly a typographical error?
I don't know if I can speak to exactly how the court will react on this. I would certainly argue, and I would just continue to argue, that even if it's a typographical error, the fact is it's gone through the review, it's gone through proponent's analysis, it's gone through your analysis, and it's now set here. And the question becomes, should proponents be allowed to make slight changes under the rubric of typographical errors late in the process? And I think that does open the door from a policy standpoint to mischief in the process here.
Well, and just to be a little stubborn here, just for the sake of considering one side of this, if the proponents had made that correction before submitting to the Secretary of State, so that, and I'm assuming, again, for the sake of argument, this really was just a typographical error, but if they had said in Section 4 that 3929105 is submitted to read and then said 3929105 with the new subsection 3, if they had done that in the version they submitted to the Secretary of State, would it have changed anything in the discussion or the consideration about the measure with respect to single subject or the setting of titles?
That I don't know. I can't answer that.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Gessler about the motion for rehearing?
No, but I have one question for the proponents.
Okay, well, let's hear from Mr. Ramey, I think, on behalf of proponents. Thank you, Mr. Gessler. You didn't have anything else?
No, I don't.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Edward Ramey, on behalf of the proponents, let me first respond to the. It is a typographical error. I just noticed that. Obviously, I would submit that that's a correction that the board can make. And I would note that the way that the initiative is prepared, it does say in Section 4 that 3929105 is amended to read as follows. And then the typographical error appears in the wording of the amendment. Certainly not trying to renumber the statute, so it is a typographical error. We would request file that correction, and it should be 3920. The other issues that Mr. Gessler has raised, I'm again, in the interest of time, I'm going to, unless you have any specific questions, I'll go into them.
I just have one specific question, and it's, do you acknowledge, as you did on number 88, that at least some of the purposes for which this money is being used have no logical connection to one another or to the tax, other than that it's part of the coalition you've created that you could think you could get to back this?
Yes. I mean, this is not as starkly posed to you, Mr. Gessler. But there are two primary. One is, I guess I would characterize as hold harmless provisions, current uses being maintained, and the other focuses on higher education issues. We don't have other issues such as preservation.
Right.
But to a lesser and less starkly posed degree, there are similar questions posed. And a response I could go at length would be the same.
Right. That's all I have.
Okay. Let's go back to the issue of the section number, I guess. I mean, you're making that request. That may be challenged if the board grants that request. It does seem to me that on its face, it's just that it is just a typographical error. I mean, it's the only, you know, as you pointed out, the Section 4, the amending clause says that it's 3929, and everything about it only makes sense if it's indeed a new subsection 3 to the existing 39-29-105. I mean, I can support that motion. And you know, even though there will be some risk it does seem to push the envelope a little bit with respect to what the court has expressly said that the title board can do.
I think that's true. Mr. Hobbs, I do think you identified the policy issue there as well. We're not at a point yet where anybody's being disadvantaged.
Mm-hmm.
Such a point would come, but certainly at this stage we're still in the context of the title. For example, we aren't able to go out and circulate print petitions after the rehearing, so we're still in the context. We do not have a final title.
Well, and I would surmise that everybody understood it. I can't speak for everybody. I guess I think I probably understood it. I just didn't notice that it said 39-39, and I don't think anybody. I would be troubled if somebody was disadvantaged. That an objection that could have been raised, that the board acted in a way that could have been different, and that an objection could have been raised in a motion for rehearing that now is foreclosed, perhaps. But in fact, it's a good catch, and it is raised in a motion for rehearing, and I think it makes some logical sense to try to correct it now at this stage.
Yeah, I mean, if we have the authority to fix typos, this is precisely the sort of thing that it seems to me it should be used for. Now, the reason that I think in the one case there's discussion of it being done at the beginning is I could see if there was a situation where we had assumed that it meant one thing based on a typo, but then later on in the rehearing the proponent said, oh, you know what, really we didn't mean that at all, what we meant was the opposite of that. If, for example, the issue in one of the prior measures where we were confused a little bit about the effective date, if we went and it was an important part of the measure and we went down a road assuming that it was July 1st and then at the rehearing the proponents said, oh, you know, that's a typo, it's supposed to be January 1st, then it might be too late to raise it. But in this case, we all assumed it was 29. And frankly, that part of the measure, I think, is irrelevant. It's not, the language there isn't actually part of the operative part of the measure. You're adding a new subsection, so all that's actually being added is the part from the subsection 3, that title language is already in 39-29-105, which has a 1 and a 2, and you're adding a new 3. You're not even adding to the statutes this introductory number or title. That's already in there. So to me, totally irrelevant. It's just a way to identify what you're doing, and the fact that there's a typo in there, I think, is exactly the sort of thing that if we have any authority to change measures, this is what it's supposed to be used for.
Well, I guess, I don't know whether it's the right time. I think I'll go ahead and move that the board approve the request of the proponents to correct the section number under section, the amending clause to section 4, so that it refers to 39-29-105 in the caption instead of 39-39-105.
I would second that.
Moved and seconded by Ms. Eubanks. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Mr. Ramey, did you have anything else in response to the motion for rehearing?
I think, Mr. Hobbs, we fully discussed all of this initiative or others.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Gessler, anything further? And thank you. Any discussion by the board or a motion?
Well, I'm in the same place I am on the single subject, that this, while it doesn't have as many disparate purposes that the money's being used for, has at least two, and if that troubles me, and if
but I'm in the same place I am as on 88, so I'm going to vote for it and look forward to getting some guidance.
Ms. Eubanks?
I was just going to, for the same reasons that we've discussed on previous measures that are similar, and these the same arguments have been made, I would move that we deny the motion for rehearing.
I guess maybe let me suggest rewording that just a little bit. Let me try.
Do we have to do that to reflect the typo?
I think so. Okay. If you were to say that we grant the motion to the extent that the board granted the request to amend the text and deny the motion in all other respects, that'd be okay?
Sure.
So that's the motion before the board. Pardon me?
Well, if that's your motion, then I'll second it.
Okay, that's my motion, and Ms. Eubanks seconded. Mr. Domenico.
That's procedurally correct.
I just want to reiterate that I agree with Mr. Gessler that these titles would be much better with the specified percentages in the title, even though I think they satisfy our statutory obligation as they are. I think they would be much better, and it would be a low cost, fairly decent benefit to adding them in there. So I just, for the record, say I think they'd be better with it.
If there's no other discussion, then all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That completes action on number 78. The next agenda item is 2007-2008 number 68, severance tax, which is also before us on a motion for rehearing. Mr. Gessler.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. Again, for the record, my name is Scott Gessler. I represent Mr. Dempsey in the motion for rehearing for number 68. I guess with the board's permission, I'll dispense of the issues that the board has discussed at length, just make very brief arguments for the record, and then the fiscal note issue.
I think that's good. Oh, I'm sorry. On the fiscal note?
Yeah, and then I'll move to the fiscal impact.
Impact, okay.
So with respect to the single subject, each one of these arguments has been presented to the board already in a prior discussion. I believe it was involving number 71, I believe it was. But under our analysis, the proposal contains various four separate subjects. One is the increase on the severance tax. One, which we've just discussed with respect to number 78, is spending mandates that are disparate and disconnected from one another and from the severance tax. That's because of the coalition building and log rolling that the single subject is specifically designed to prohibit. The items number 3 and 4 are related, and they have to do with the new land conservation fund, the fact that is not connected with the severance tax, logically dependent upon it, and likewise the change in the duties of the GOCO board. I'm happy to make further discussion. For their argument, the board's heard everything I've said in the past. So unless you have questions, I'll limit it at that.
Okay, and appreciate that. I think we basically can incorporate our prior discussions on similar measures and on this measure. And any questions for Mr. Gessler? Okay.
And then along the same lines, the second item with respect to the incomplete title. The fact that the title fails to increase percentages on critical issues of how the money is going to be spent. And then the last two, the issue of the preservation of land and water resources as a catchphrase. We argued this exact same point in an earlier provision. So unless the board has questions or wants me to repeat those arguments, I won't. Item number 4 is different. It uses the phrase clean energy, which would be something anyone would like to vote for because cleanliness is some people's view next to godliness, and clean energy just must be good. And I think that could easily serve as a catchphrase, increase severance taxes so that we can have clean energy in Colorado. So even though the name of the fund is the Clean Energy Fund, I don't think that exempts it from using the term clean energy as an improper catchphrase. It does work to the proposal's favor, and I don't think it adds a substantial amount of information. That argument I have not made before the board. The principles involved in catchphrase are relatively straightforward. The argument here really focuses on the issue of the use of the word clean energy. Because I don't think anyone would ever vote for dirty energy. Clean energy is obviously something that has a very positive connotation here. State.
Do you have a suggestion for how we could concisely refer to the Clean Energy Fund without saying Clean Energy Fund?
I think some ways that you could do it, and I don't have precise language that I can propose before the board, but it would certainly describe in a more functional way what the Clean Energy Fund funds. For example, it obviously doesn't fund oil and gas extraction, but it would fund, you know, certain other types of energy production, such as wind energy or solar energy, or perhaps describe it as non-fossil fuel energy, rather than using the word clean energy, describing what this clean energy is intended to describe.
Any other questions for Mr. Gessler? Thank you.
Okay. With that, I'd like to turn to the turn to the fiscal note.
Yeah.
And I admit I do that with some trepidation as an attorney wading into the vagaries of tax analysis. But what I have is several documents for the board to look at, and I do have copies for the proponents or the proponent's representative, whoever that may be. As an initial matter, what I have here is an analysis by the Colorado Energy Research Institute, which is part of the Colorado School of Mines from Golden, Colorado, in Golden, Colorado. If I may approach the board here. Let me give you these three copies here. So what I've provided is a copy of the entire report, which is 100 and some pages, and then I've copied the relevant portions. I've just copied the relevant portions that I will that I'll refer to. And specifically, this report was produced by the, like I said before, the Colorado Energy Research Institute at the Colorado School of Mines. And there's really two points that I'd like the board to look at. That's item, first of all, on page 12, Roman numeral 12, I should say. At the very bottom, there's a chart. And in the first or second column of the chart, it lists the estimated, well, actually, I'm not sure how estimated this is, because the number seems fairly precise, of the property taxes on production and equipment paid by the paid on oil and gas, or oil and gas drilling here in Colorado. And this is, and that number is $315 million and a little bit over that. And basically, if you look on the paragraph above that chart, and also on page 57 of this report, it explains the methodology that they used to come up with that number. And that methodology is based on analysis by Booz Allen and a model produced by Duff and Phelps, a model they produced in 2007 to do this estimation. That's the one important point. The second important point is that this is 2006 taxes, which is based on the 2005 assessments. Those are sort of the two critical points. I'm happy to read from the report, but I think I've just summarized it. It's only about four paragraphs between pages 12 and 57. So what I produced are the excerpts for that and then the entire report if you want to look at that. But I would mention about the entire report that it's a very thorough report, numerous teams and analyzing this, and a thorough analysis of the economic impacts of the oil and gas industry in Colorado. But for purposes of the fiscal impact, it's number 12 and number 57. Those pages. Just for a moment,
sure.
I want to show the entire report.
Okay.
Just for the record, I wanted to show the entire report. I failed to bring enough copies with me, but I showed the entire report to the proponents there. So from that point, that $315 million tax assessment for property and equipment based on the 2005 values and the 2006 taxes, what I sought to do is provide an extrapolation based on that for 2008 based on sort of just the property taxes. So what I sought to do is identify the component or roughly estimate the component that is just property taxes, not equipment taxes, of that $315 million number, and then extrapolate that number to what it would be for the 2008 valuation, which would produce the 2009 taxes. I'll tell the board at the outset, I am not contending that I have an exact number to replace this fiscal analysis, but what I am trying to show is that I think the current fiscal impact substantially understates the amount and therefore is misleading. So with that, if I may approach, I've got a few other documents. So what I just handed are the Colorado assessed values from the Colorado Division of Property and Taxation. And the second page of the handout shows the oil and gas property valuations. And if you look at the year 2005, that number was about a little over $5 million. By way of comparison to the CERI, SERI, I think SERI is how you pronounce it, report, that based on a 2005 estimate of $4.9 million. So the state is a little bit higher. The SERI underestimated that by a very slight amount. So if you look at 2005, the oil and gas property valuation is $5 million. For 2006, that increased to $7.3 million. For 2007, it slightly dropped to $7.2 million. So those are the increases in the actual assessed value. And the reason why that's important is, of course, because the taxes are driven off of the assessed value. And then I have two more documents, but if I may approach, I've got one more on its way. What this next document is, it's a annual report. It's excerpts from the annual report to the General Assembly. This actual report is available on the Colorado's website. I didn't produce the entire thing. It's 773 pages. So it's very, very thorough. But if you look to page 9 of that report, page 10, it describes essentially what the increases in the valuation. And on page 10, in the second column, the second full paragraph, it explains that basically the value of the property is highly variable because it's based on the sales price of oil and gas. It's based on that. And therefore, the increase in the value, the substantial increase from 2005 to 2006, was driven in part because of the increases in the price of oil, and it explains in part why it's a highly volatile calculation. If you look at, I apologize, it doesn't have page numbers, but the fourth page third page from the end, there's a chart entitled Abstract Data by Class of Property. And that simply sort of reinforces, that repeats the $5 million 2005 assessed valuation, $7.3 million 2006 assessed valuation.
I'm sorry, which page is that? Third one from the end?
It should, no, I'm sorry, it's not the third one from the end. And I apologize, these aren't. If you look at page 11, okay, and then go to two pages following that. I apologize for that. There should be a chart entitled Abstract Data by Class of Property.
Okay.
Okay, and the last line within the category of Class of Property says oil and gas, and that simply repeats those numbers. So what this is doing is this is an effort to, that of that $315 million, identify the growth in that number, okay, based on assessed valuations. And so what I'm showing here is of that $315 million, based on the 2005 numbers, that number is substantially higher by a large percentage based on the increase in the assessed valuations. The last thing that I tried to do, sort of extrapolated into the future, that $315 million is based on property and equipment. So it's important, as I understand it, because the ad valorem tax credit is not based on based on equipment, the business personal property. It's based on real estate or land values. So it's important to try and come up with some estimate to divide out those two numbers. And identify some percentage that would be allocated to property and some percentage that would be allocated to the personal property or equipment. And the report from 2006, the same report you're looking at, provides an indication of that. If you look on page 11, the second column, it identifies business personal property. Category that says personal property in 2006. And it basically says that the property, that personal property accounts for a little over 11, almost 12% of the property tax base. And what I did then, finally, in looking at this report, I apologize for skipping around a little bit, if you go back to that abstract data by class of property page, the page following that provides a chart of abstract data by type of property. And if you look towards the middle of that page, under type slash class of property, the last column there, that is the breakout of the 2006, that $7.2 million or $7.3 million number. And it divides it into land, which is about almost 6.8, a little bit over $6.7 million. Billion dollars, shows you the improvements column and the personal property column, and then of course adds it all up. And based on these numbers, you can see for 2006, the personal property plus improvements about $570 million, which is less than 10%, substantially less than 10% of the $7.3 billion. Calculation there is the $7.3 billion, 10% of that would be about $730 million, which is more than the improvements plus the personal property tax base. So if I may approach, I've got a final chart where I've tried to put this together. May I approach?
Yeah. Thank you.
And what I've done here is try to consolidate these analyses for an estimate of the 2008 tax base, which would result in the 2009 tax. So if you look at the first column, The property valuation, I've simply replicated that from the Colorado assessed values for 2005, 2006, and 2008. And then I extrapolated, I'm sorry, 2005 through 2007. And then I extrapolated for 2008. And the way in which I did this is I identified, if you look at the third line from the bottom, January 1st U.S. spot price for crude oil. That's the January 1st for each one of those years. And it shows you that it goes from $33.79 a barrel in 2005 to, in 2008, actual data, $88.41 a barrel. And what I did is I calculated the percentage in increase in that. You can see from 2005 to 2006 it went to 57.7%. 2007 it dropped 3.2%. And then it jumps again 71% for 2008. I also provided that information. The source of that information is from the Energy Information Administration, and I provided the website for that. I don't put this as the exact numbers for what Colorado producers are receiving. I put this in here as a basis to show you the magnitude of increases. For example, if you go to the EIA website, they have spot crude prices for, I guess there's a hub in Oklahoma, so you can find the spot price in Oklahoma. You can find the international price, which is a little bit different than the U.S. price. But this captures the magnitude of these increases in a relevant manner. And so to extrapolate the property valuation from 2007 to 2008, I increased it by a factor of 50% from 2007 to 2008. The reason I did that is if you look at the percentages and the increase in valuation from 2005 to 6 to 7, it's a 45% increase and then a 1.4% drop. And that roughly tracks the change in the U.S. spot oil price, the U.S. spot price, crude oil. So in other words, much of the difference in the value of the land that's assessed here, the value of the assessments, can be explained by the changes in the crude oil prices. Crude oil prices for January 1st of 2008, they were $88.41. Since then, they've continued to increase. That's a 71.4% increase. I used a much lower one, a 50% increase, as the extrapolation for the 2008 values. I'm recognizing this isn't precise, but I'm trying to give the board a sense of the magnitudes here. What I did, the third line on the chart, is after you look at the property valuation increases, based on the SERI methodology, or at least the SERI numbers, to extrapolate those, the taxes for property would be $675 million for 2008. I'm sorry, for 2009, based on the 2008 valuations, which themselves are based upon the increase in the price of oil. What I did is I allocated 90% of that to real property taxes, assuming from that chart that I had earlier showed you that less than 10% of the total value is for real business, real property, and for improvements. So I simply took that 10% out and I said, well, 90% of this is based on the land. And then from that, I calculated the 87.5% ad valorem credit. That's in statute the portion of the credit that people get. And based on that 87.5% credit, the final number for 2008 numbers, which would be the 2009 taxes, would be $531,790,199. That's a misleading level of preciseness. But my goal is to show a sense of the magnitude that the ad valorem credit will easily approach $531 million for 2009. By eliminating the ad valorem credit, you would be raising taxes by $531 million for 2009. Now, I'm not purporting that this is an exact calculation, but I am arguing that this shows the magnitude of the increase, which is substantially, which is twice, more than twice as much as the $260.8 million increase. And it's listed in the ballot and the title, and of that $260 million, $213 million is allocated to the elimination of the ad valorem credit. So my argument is that that number of $260 million should probably be double, if not perhaps more, assessing what the fiscal impact or how much the taxes will actually be raised. So with that, I've sort of laid out my analysis, provided you the sources that I have for this. I'm happy to take questions, but I'm certainly willing to take questions and perhaps be disabused if I've made some error in my assumptions, but I believe that this is a reasonable read of the available sources, most of which come from the state, but one which comes from the Colorado Energy Research Institute.
Questions for Mr. Gessler? Ms. Eubanks?
Not that I'll be checking your math, but in terms of, I mean, you've given us one figure. We've got another figure from OSPB, significant amount of revenue difference. In light of the potential for underestimating, I'm just curious, are you aware of the provision, you know, the language is a requirement of Tabor, and are you aware of what Tabor provides if revenues exceed the estimate that's included in a ballot issue in the title?
If you could tell me exactly what you're referring to.
Where it talks about, I mean, and I'm looking at subsection 3 of section 20 of Article 10. It talks about that if a tax increase or fiscal year spending exceeds any estimate in B3, which is the requirement to start out with the mandatory language, shall taxes be increased by blank amount, for the same fiscal year, the tax increase is thereafter reduced up to 100% in proportion to the combined dollar excess and the combined excess revenue refunded in the next fiscal year. I mean, it's always been my understanding that basically if revenues come in, if the fiscal impact of a measure, a tax increase, comes in higher than the estimate, then either the tax has to be adjusted so that it comes back down to that estimated amount and any amount that was collected and above that amount refunded. Is that your understanding of that provision of Tabor?
I'm sort of chuckling because during a previous hearing, Mr. Ramey and I had that similar colloquy on that exact issue, and I think we had agreed to disagree. For the record, I'm unwilling to take a position because I think there's not a lot of guidance either way on that particular point. As we had discussed, as Mr. Ramey and I had discussed.
Have we ever, does anyone know if we, the state, have ever done that, or any district, as Tabor calls them, has ever refunded money because the amount was underestimated? Because that's the way I read Tabor, but you would think that it would have happened somewhere along the line and we would know. And I'm just not aware of it.
In terms of the state, I'm not sure that the state has ever passed a tax increase since Tabor was in place, so I'm not sure we've had that situation. In terms of local governments, I don't know offhand whether any have come in, the revenues have come in above the stated amount, and therefore the tax was reduced. But and Mr. Gessler, I appreciate your response. I understand. I mean, I don't think, to my knowledge, there's been any interpretation of that provision. But it does say something in terms of what it would actually cause to happen in that circumstance.
And perhaps to muddy the water, I mean, this particular initiative seeks to, you know, de-boost these funds as well. So I guess the question is, can a measure by its own terms exempt itself from that provision?
And that may be subject to debate, too. I think that
right.
Generally, at least my understanding of de-brucing is purely in terms of the spending, fiscal year spending and revenue limits that are set forth, but that's just my understanding. So thank you.
So in conclusion, I don't have a number that I believe with any absolute certainty I can provide the board, and I apologize for that. But I believe I have provided evidence to show that the current number before the board is misleading.
Mr. Gessler, even though you don't have a number, I guess I'm, at least for the sake of seeing if I'm tracking in the slightest what your information is suggesting. Would I be totally misunderstanding what you've presented here to say that we could derive a number if we combined the $531 million from your chart with the $47.5 million in the OSPB estimate for the small wells exemption? Those are the two numbers that I think would give us a number.
That's a logical outcome. I won't fully support that just because the $531 million number, I mean, these are based on what I'd argue are relatively rough estimates showing the magnitude of changes. For example, a lot of that's based on a 50% increase from 2007 to 2008, and truthfully, that's a bit of a guess. And if you look at the spot prices for crude oil, that number itself has two limitations. One, it's not Colorado specific, and two, it's only based on the January 1st price, whereas the numbers vary throughout the year. And I think a more refined, if you pardon the pun, a more refined analysis would be required to zero in on that number better. So, I mean, conceivably the number could be lower than the $531 million. Conceivably it could be higher. I just don't feel confident in saying to the board the $531 million number is the number. And so I guess what I would request is that the board instead ask OSPB to take this analysis into consideration and perhaps defer the measure, but to take this analysis into consideration and identify where they disagree with it or where they may agree with it in changing these numbers. For example, they may believe that the SERI report is completely wrong. I believe that the SERI report is very carefully analyzed, and there may be vagaries within the counties or on a more micro level as to what percentage goes to property and what percentage doesn't. So I mean, the board certainly has the authority to do that, but I apologize that I just don't feel enough comfort of the analysis to say that is the number.
Well, and I think OSPB seems to agree with you as far as the difficulty in coming up with an estimate. I mean, their estimate says one of their caveats is that severance taxes are extremely volatile. Energy prices are determined by global supply and demand and are highly sensitive to unforeseeable economic and geopolitical events. I mean, the kinds of things that I think you're very well identifying here.
I would argue that level of variability is not as great as the sloppiness of this particular analysis. And the reason I'd say that is we currently have three months of data on exactly what oil prices are and those differences. And with a more refined analysis, we can get a much better sense of exactly how that drives the assessed valuation. Now, we don't have it for all 12 months of 2008, but we certainly have it for 3 months. And we also, I think, have a very good guess that it's highly unlikely that those numbers are going to drop to, for example, the 2005 levels of $33 a barrel. And I think there's a good guess that they're probably not going to go up to $100 a barrel. But so we do have a relatively identifiable range in which to operate for the 2008 numbers because the fiscal, because the tax increase is only based on the 2009 tax increase, which is based on the 2008 numbers, of which we already have almost, I should say, 3 months of data, perhaps soon 4 months of data. I don't know how fast that data gets generated.
Well, and I don't know whether it's a good idea or not to ask OSPB to do additional analysis. I think we're not bound by the OSPB analysis. I mean, anyone that can bring to us better analysis, and we can go with that as well. On the one hand, we could delay this perhaps and try to get some input from OSPB about whether or not they agree with the information you've presented, but you have presented really good information. The downside is it, do we need to delay? We're never going to get a precise number because it's a crystal ball that we're asking for that doesn't exist, and your analysis is pretty good. So I don't know whether it's worth I mean, it's a lot to digest. But on the other hand, you know, we're here on a motion for rehearing, and I'm always reluctant to delay the process. So, if somebody else comes with better analysis than OSPB, I think it's also possible for the board to accept it.
And I recognize that. I'm just trying to be straightforward as far as the questions I have about my own analysis here. And I guess the way I've looked at it is my job on the motion for rehearing is to satisfy burden of proof that or burden of persuasion, production, whatever burden it is, that number is misleading. And I guess I analogize, you know, what if the Supreme Court were to look at this and say it's misleading? It would refer it back to the title board to do further analysis to answer these questions. So even though we can't perhaps ultimately get an exact number, our goal should ultimately be to get a number where we're at least confident that it's not misleading. So that's sort of how I looked at it.
Thank you. Anything else? That's it.
Thank you.
Ms. Eubanks?
And if I could just correct my earlier statement, I do remember there was the additional cigarette and tobacco products tax that voters did approve on the state level, but I'm not aware, I hadn't ever heard that the revenues had come in higher than what the estimate was. So I did think of one tax increase, at least on the state level.
Thank you. Karavich?
Karavich for the proponents. Without addressing any of the issues we've addressed in response to 71 or earlier this morning on other initiatives, first, with respect to Mr. Gessler's argument that it's misleading under 4 because of the phrase clean energy, that is a fund that's already established under 2475-1201 at SEC called the Clean Energy Fund. So that's not a new term, that's new to this.
Right, but would you agree that there could be, I mean, say, believe it or not, there are some people who find the term Patriot Act to be sort of a catchphrase and misleading and the sort of thing that's instituted, that's tagged on to the title of an act to sort of force people into
supporting it,
despite the substance. And so don't you think that even if clean energy itself we don't agree, isn't it possible that simply referring to an existing program could in some cases be a catchphrase if the program itself, the title of it is a catchphrase?
I guess anything's possible, but I think the title is accurate as to what's going on.
Well, right, but that's different. It's different to say it's inaccurate as to say it includes a catchphrase. Right. I mean, I agree with you. It's accurate. I'm just, and I don't think that clean energy quite rises to the level of a catchphrase, but it's not simple. I don't think we can just say, well, we're referring to an existing program with that title, and therefore it can never be a catchphrase. I mean, do you agree with me on that?
That it could never be a catchphrase?
Yeah.
Unrelated to this one? Yeah.
Right. So the real question is just, is clean energy a catchphrase even though it refers to an existing program? And I think I'm comfortable, as you are, that it's not.
It's certainly not misleading, inaccurate, or incomplete.
Right, right.
With respect to Mr. Gessler's argument on the amount of the tax, we are happy to let him submit his information. Hold this over.
Probably 3 weeks, actually.
Well, I would like to state very clearly that I think that Tabor has to be interpreted the way Ms. Eubanks suggested. Otherwise, these will always be misleading, and it would be impossible to write an accurate title. It has to be that if the amount goes over the number we put in there, that it's refunded, and that the general debrucing language within it can't exempt it from going over that. Otherwise, these are always based on guesses and estimates. And if in fact, whatever we put in there is going to be somebody's estimate, guessing at property values, which themselves fluctuate based on oil prices, which fluctuate based on the whims of some guys in Saudi Arabia, and this is always going to be a guess. And so unless it's interpreted in that way, these will always be misleading. So the only way I can vote in favor of any definitive statement that says shall taxes be increased by any number at all is with the understanding that if the tax revenue brought in by this increase goes over that number, that it will be refunded. Otherwise, the system just doesn't work. With that in mind, whatever number the proponents want to put in there is fine with me. The proponents then, with that understanding, are faced with a good choice of balancing putting in a big scary number that might cause their measure to be voted down versus putting in a low number that may end up having to refund lots of money they otherwise could have collected. So if we should probably come up with a good estimate, but if you came in here and said, we want to eliminate this, but only up to $100 million, then it would be fine with me to put in $100 million in there with the understanding that anything would go over it, even though we all know everyone's estimates are it would bring in more than that. And on the other hand, if you came in and said, shall taxes be increased by $20 billion, I'd be fine with that too, because then you'd be able to keep everything if it came in, but you'd run the risk that people would be scared off by that big number. So that's where I am on this estimate, is I'm willing to take whatever the proponents are happy with.
And I don't think that there's a clear understanding as to whether that is what happens if you debrief, or if you debrief and you also add language that you're exempt from any other spending limitation, you can keep any revenue collected, whether that gets you out of that refund provision. I don't think there's any law on that point yet.
Yeah, well, I don't know how we could both use the language Tabor requires us to use and let you get out of the refund provision. I agree that debruising is basically a spending limit provision, and I think Tabor by its nature doesn't allow you to do kind of an open-ended tax increase. That's kind of what I'm saying.
I understand that, and then this and this is what Mr. Gessler was pointing to, is that this initiative also says that they're exempt from any other law without limitations and without limiting in any year the amount of other revenue that may be collected. So though unsure, we don't have any case law on how the general debruising languages works, or adding a provision that's broader would work as well.
Right.
So, let Mr. Gessler submit his information. Give them a third chance at getting a number, and then, because I'm certainly not qualified to.
Well, and I'm okay with that. As one member of the board, I was concerned about the delay, and if the proponents are okay with that, I think that weighs in favor of trying to get a better estimate.
Well, in the interest of establishing some legislative history, is it the intent of the proponents that their debruising language be interpreted to get them around not just spending limits, but also the cap, in effect, turning what we've got as a clear statement with a clear number into basically just a guess? Or is it your intent simply to say that the spending limits don't apply, but will abide by if the tax goes over this, there'll be a refund? Because I'm not sure I can vote for it if you guys think you can keep any amount of tax this brings in, no matter what number we put in there.
I think the law's not clear on this point, so.
Well, right, and I'm just trying to establish my own, on the record, my own understanding of what I'm voting for, and also hoping that you would agree with me, so that when law is established, we'll all be on the same spot. If you see what I'm saying.
I do understand what you're saying. Uh, I think this is where I was going before, is because there's no case law on point as to the effect of general debruising language or word, I can't take a position on.
You can't take a position on what the proponent's intent is?
Right. I can't take a position on what we would do in the event that this would take in more tax than the number we would use on a title.
That's too bad.
All right. That's fine, though. I mean, my position, though, is that if that I would not vote in favor of this if I understood it to mean that that 260.8 or whatever number we put in there is irrelevant. So,
and when you say you would not vote in favor of this, you mean?
I would say the title. I would say if that two, if we vote on a title that says state taxes shall be increased by X number, when really what we're asking people to vote on is state taxes shall be increased by whatever amount they bring in, I would not vote in favor of the title if I understood that it could be interpreted in the latter way rather than the former, because I think it would be misleading in the most fundamental way possible. So, but my understanding of what we're doing is, in fact, voting on the on something that does impose a real limit on how much taxes will be increased. And because that's my understanding, I will vote in favor of the title with whatever number anybody wants to put in there.
Peanuts in my pocket.
That's fine. I mean, yeah, I'll take off, and I'm sure Dan will be showing up. But
yeah.
Can I make a suggestion? What if we were, I don't think that there were any, can we either figure out if there are any other changes we want to make and hold this, I think I've heard the proponents say they're willing to hold this over for 2 weeks and decide if a better number, if they or anybody can come up with a better number. So can we just do that? And with the understanding that maybe you all extract a commitment about their intent at that point?
A I'm sorry, you said first.
My basic proposal is we essentially do what you, I think, suggested a little while ago, which was hold this over for 2 weeks and see if you or OSPB, working with Mr. Gessler's numbers and whoever else, can come up with a better number to put in there, and then we can consider that at our next meeting, and then we can move on for today.
Is there any objection to the board laying this over? There's other people signed up to testify. I don't want to cut anybody off, so if anybody wants to still testify, that's fine, but I think the proposal in front of us is simply to lay it over at this point to the next regularly scheduled title board meeting, which I think is May 7th. Any objection?
None from the proponents.
None from Mr. Gessler?
No.
None from anybody else present? Then I'll go ahead and make the motion then that the board lay this over until May 7th, the next board meeting, May 7th. And that in the meantime, we will also contact OSPB. We'll arrange for the information that Mr. Gessler provided to be provided to OSPB to see if there's a revision in their estimate. Ms. Eubanks.
And just for clarification, that in terms of OSPB being given Mr. Gessler's contact information, so that as they're looking at these materials, he can explain how he comes up with his figure, because, I mean, they might be able to figure it out all by themselves, but I just think that's an important part.
Any objection to that?
I would just hope that if there are any such contacts, that Ms. Veach is kept in the loop, just to avoid any issues.
Okay. I think that's agreed to. So the motion is to lay it over.
Second. I second it.
Seconded by 2 seconds. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. For today, completes action on number 68. And the time is 12:37 p.m. Let's then move on to the next agenda item. That's number 2007-2008, number 83, fees on energy emissions.
Yes, thank you. My name is Mimi Larson, and I'm here representing Mr. Ross. In respect to the motion for rehearing on Initiative 83, you have been provided a copy with the motion for rehearing, and within that motion sets forth our arguments as to why the initiative actually does contain more than one subject. And if you don't mind, I'd like to just take a moment or two to go over some of those items.
Okay.
Under the broad theme of global warming, the initiative attempts to link several unrelated subjects which should be addressed in separate initiatives. The initiative is proposing to tax consumers on their carbon emissions, which result from consumption of electricity and natural gas. The initiative is also proposing to regulate carbon as a pollutant through the mandate that a carbon sequestration program be implemented. This carbon sequestration program would allow for not only terrestrial sequestration, but also geological sequestration. It is through the geological sequestration that the regulation of carbon would result. Currently, carbon is not a regulated pollutant either under federal law, the Clean Air Act, or any other federal regulation, or under Colorado law. The initiative will also assign authority to the Departments of Agriculture and Natural Resources and the Governor's Energy Office to implement emission control regulations. These emission control regulations stem from the implementation of the carbon sequestration program. Because the initiative will implement this sequestration program, which then results in the regulation of carbon, the program will, that program, which would normally be implemented by the Air Quality Control Commission, that authority actually is now being transferred over to the Departments of Ag and Natural Resources and the Governor's Energy Office. Because carbon is not a regulated pollutant, however, and the Commission is prohibited from implementing any regulation or standard which is, quote, otherwise more stringent than the requirements of the Clean Air Act, and that's found in CRS 257105.1, the Commission would be unable to implement such a program. Therefore, the initiative provides that the Departments of Agriculture and Natural Resources, with the Governor's Office, will implement this program. The result is it's vesting authority into two departments and the Governor's Energy Office, which authority should, in fact, be with the Commission. Finally, the initiative will result in prohibiting future General Assemblies from repealing or reducing funding to certain programs. Because of these reasons, we find that the initiative, in fact, fails to meet the single subject requirement. I'm happy to take questions on this issue right now if you'd like. Also discuss why the title fails to meet its requirements as well.
Any questions at this point? Why don't you, well?
I've got questions, but I think for the proponents, so I'd say go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. With respect to the ballot title and submission clause, it is confusing and misleading at this point. The title fails to inform the voters of who exactly is to be taxed. It's unclear as to whether the tax is only assessed on consumers or if that may also apply to electricity producers. The ballot title fails to adequately describe what activity will result in the tax being assessed. Is it only on consumption? Is it on the production of energy? Or is it both? The voters are not told within the title what the amount of the tax is that they will be assessed. While the title currently does provide what the estimated amount of revenues will be, it doesn't inform the voter what that fee or what that tax, what that rate is that they will be assessed. The fee should be referred to throughout the title as a tax. It is in fact a tax and it's not a fee. The title fails to adequately describe to the voters the extent of the statutory and policy changes it will result in. The initiative will result in, as I've mentioned before, a new regulatory scheme, and it will repeal the long-standing tradition that future General Assemblies may not be prohibited from acting. And neither of those issues are addressed fully within the title. The title fails to inform voters as to what forms of pollution reduction measures their money will be spent on. Voters are not do not know who is in charge of allocating the revenues that are collected from this tax. Finally, the title contains catchphrases such as global warming and pollution, words that will work to the initiative's favor without contributing to voter understanding, and therefore should be removed.
Questions for Ms. Larson? Ms. Eubanks?
In terms of the catchphrase, the global warming, I believe that's in regard to, climate change.
I misspoke. You're right. Climate change.
Okay, that's in regard to the requirement under the measure for a portion of the revenues to be funding a permanent staff position, senior advisor on climate change, and that's my understanding that that's created by executive order. Since that's the name of the position, how would you suggest eliminating that supposed catchphrase when that's the title of the position which the measure requires to be funded?
No, at this point, I really can't take a position as to how that could be reworded, merely because it is an office that, or a position that's been created by executive order, does not mean that, though, by including it within the title, it could be considered as a catchphrase. And in fact, it does rise to the level of
thank you.
One of the things I wanted to ask about, I'm still trying to catch up here. You're pretty fast, so I'm just and it's a pretty long motion for rehearing. Subsection 4, I'm just trying to find where it is. I wanted to think a little bit, think through this, the argument that's on page 9 of the motion for rehearing about preventing future legislatures from amending the act. And trying to find the provision in the measure. Point me to that. And I knew where it was.
Section 4A, I believe?
Yes, just 4.
Section 4.
So I think 3 pages in.
Okay. Ah, okay. So, the sentence that reads that such existing programs shall not be repealed or reduced by the General Assembly in consideration of this section. This is a separate subject. Is that
correct?
The argument.
Yes.
What would prevent the General Assembly from amending that sentence in future legislation, and for example, striking that?
To my knowledge, I don't know that they would be prohibited from amending that section. However, by on its face, the fact that the initiative is proposing to prohibit the General Assembly from acting in the future is on it, in and of itself, a separate subject which is being proposed.
So even though it may be ineffective, it's by its existence, it's a separate subject.
That's correct.
But doesn't it relate directly to the measure? I mean, it's trying to prevent the General Assembly from having an effect on this measure. I mean, how would it
well,
be?
Well, it encompasses more than just this measure. The language is very broad, and it doesn't specify that only programs which relate specifically to this measure would be considered under Section 4. It provides that the fees imposed by this section shall be in addition to any other program, including job creation, economic development, et cetera. And then those existing programs, so any other job creation, economic development program that addresses job development and economic development outside of this new energy economy would be affected by this section.
Okay. Hopefully I understood that, but it just seems like it's just trying to ensure that the fees derived from this measure will be supplementary and not substituted for any of those programs. I mean, even though it goes to these other programs, it seems like this is not a separate and distinct purpose or subject.
Well, Section 4 provides that the General Assembly may not actually reduce or repeal any of these programs. So even if you had a job development program that focused on an industry outside of what would be considered the new energy economy for purposes of this initiative, by the statute, the General Assembly would be prohibited from either repealing or reducing funding to that job creation program merely as a result of this language. So the General Assembly may find that there's a job creation program that is ineffective or monies need to be allocated elsewhere. The language that is provided for in here would prohibit that action to be taken.
Okay. Other questions for Ms. Larson? Thank you. Not sure who. I've got other people signed up. Is there anybody else who wants to address the motion for rehearing? Yes, sir. Go ahead. I'm not sure what order to go in. I've got 3 other people that said that they wanted to testify, but go ahead.
Okay. My name is Tom McKenna, and I'm here with Clean Energy Progress. May I just go down the point?
Yes, go right ahead.
All right. So point number 2 of the motion, it says that, arguing against the single subject, we're implementing separate and distinct programs. We already had a discussion on this point 2 weeks ago on April 2nd, and I think perhaps the most cogent argument that was brought up was to income taxes. If there was income taxes on the ballot, that those funds would be spent for different things. We're spending money for funds for different things, although they are closely related to the single subject of global warming. Throughout the motion, there is a fallacious argument made that we're trying to regulate carbon dioxide. We're putting a fee on carbon dioxide and emit all the carbon dioxide they would like to.
Can,
Can I interrupt you there? Because I think I asked you this before, because, but I just want to make sure, because it was a little more focused now, I think. Their argument is that the carbon sequestration, and I think even more specifically, the geologic carbon sequestration program, is a regulatory program rather than simply one of the funding, one of the things you're trying to fund. Do you disavow that? Is this purely something to fund programs for the state to engage in its own capture and geologic reintroduction of carbon emissions, or is that going to be used to fund some kind of regulation where energy producers are required themselves to engage in this?
That's correct. We're not putting a regulatory system in there. It's in fact in the page 4. It says despite statements made by the proponents of the initiative, at the hearing, they do not intend for the initiative to include geologic sequestration. In fact, we have $4 million in there, a maximum of $4 million for geologic sequestration, and the wording is to implement sequestration. It does not say regulate. The word regulate doesn't appear anywhere in the initiative, so we're a little baffled by why the authors of the motion are focused on that.
Okay. All right. So we won't be... you don't expect or intend for the General Assembly or anyone else to take this measure and then say, here's how we're going to implement carbon sequestration. We're going to force you, Xcel or whoever, energy producer, we're going to use this money to fund inspectors or whatever, a program requiring you to engage in this kind of sequestration yourselves. The money's going to go to some state program where a state agency does it or studies it or however they implement it.
Studies it or incentivizes it was our intent. Geologic sequestration, if it happens, will be a very expensive, very, very capital-intensive proposition. I'd like to do what we can.
Okay. That satisfies me on that point.
Okay, well, my next point is in 2B of the motion. They're claiming that carbon dioxide is not a pollutant. We believe that assertion is a clear misreading of the Supreme Court ruling on April 2nd of 2007. Justice Stevens, writing for the majority, wrote that under the Clean Air Act, the term air pollutant, quote, embraces all airborne compounds of whatever stripe, because greenhouse gases fit well within the Act's capacious definition of air pollutant. EPA has statutory authority to regulate emissions of such gases for new motor vehicles. Motor vehicles was the case they were looking at, and that was for the majority, so it was Stevens, Kennedy, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer. Let's see, in 2C of the motion, they claim that the initiative will repeal the authority of the Department of Health and Environment to promulgate emission control regulations. Again, we're giving the Governor's Energy Office and the Department of Natural Resources the responsibility to implement these programs. We say nothing about regulation whatsoever. We're not giving regulation authority to anybody, taking it away from anybody. It's simply to implement the various programs listed in subsection 6. In 2D of the motion, they claim that the initiative seeks to tie the hands of future legislators. The language that Ms. Larson finds offensive, in fact, is in our Constitution, Article 10, Section 21, Subsection 3, that's the so-called tobacco amendment. So everything in Subsection 4 of our initiative is the same as Subsection 3, which I can read if you like, but just where the word tobacco was in there, it was taken out and replaced with the fees. So it's in the state constitution already. In 3A of the motion, Ms. Larson claims that we're failing to inform the voters of who the consumers will be. This is something that we discussed probably for an hour on April 2nd. I don't think there's anything new in the motion that we haven't already talked about, so we can talk about that. If you like, in Section 3B, she's claiming that, in fact, we're not a fee, we're a tax. There's a number of arguments to that. The one I'd like to make, and some of my colleagues, I think, may want to make different ones. The notion of a fee, as is written in the motion, a fee is charged, is a charge imposed to defray the cost of a service. And a well-established area of academic research is the notion of an ecosystem service. In this field, a monetary value is calculated for services provided by ecosystems. For example, if we have a wetland might clean up groundwater as well as $1 million sewage treatment plant. So if someone were to detract from the efficacy of that wetland, they would be expected to pay a fee. So it's a very similar thing to what we're doing, carbon dioxide. Certainly the atmosphere provides tremendous services for us. And an article on that, which I can enter into the record if that would be useful. Okay.
Okay.
This was by Costanza and co-authors in the journal. On Nature, they estimated that the global sum value of eco-services, in fact, is at a minimum double the global gross national product. So, you know, one of the big problems we have is that these services that we get are not monetized, and so we make our decisions based on externalities. And so, anyway, that's why we think, in fact, this truly is a fee. We agreed at the last hearing to sort of so-called Taborize the amendment, to put tax in the first word, in the first sentence, you know, to avoid a court challenge later. And so we admit there is tax in the first one and fee later on, but we think the true spirit of it is a fee, and we, you know, by constitutional requirement, put tax in there. Let's see, Ms. Larson or Mr. Seeby in the written motion objects, this is in 3D, that there were lots of details that were not included in the title. The initiative itself is just slightly under 2,000 words. The title and attempt to summarize that got it down to 160 words by necessity. Not all the details can be carried through. And then finally, on the catchphrase argument, there are two catchphrases that, supposed catchphrases that were brought up of pollution and climate change. We think the Supreme Court has handled the pollution argument for us. I mean, the Supreme Court has determined that carbon dioxide is a pollutant, so if the Supreme Court says so, we think we could put it in here without it being a catchphrase. And with regard to the climate change, we'd simply like to agree with what Ms. Eubanks remarked earlier. We're not littering this about the title in any way of a catchphrase. We're referring to a specific a position that was initiated by Governor Ritter on April 16th of last year to establish this position of the governor's office on advisor to the governor, sorry, the climate policy change advisor, climate change policy advisor. Sorry.
Questions for Mr. McKinnon?
I have a couple, but I'm willing to wait till others have gone, but or I can go first.
I don't think I have any.
The only one of my comments, questions that has anything to do, that's outside the title, that has to do with the single subject, is related to the tying the hands of future legislators. I think we've talked about everything else plenty. And that, I think you do, you may have a legal problem with that being enforceable in trying to do that through statute as opposed to the tobacco one, which is in the Constitution, in the sense that future legislatures can always ignore statutes and change them and act as they want, unlike constitutional provisions, which they have to abide by. But I don't think that that's a single subject problem. If this were in fact a constitutional amendment, for example, then that problem goes away and you're left with saying don't eliminate these other programs based on this additional funding requirement we're imposing. the one argument that seems to make some sense is that I think that provision refers to job creation, economic development programs, which really are sort of unrelated to this. But simply saying, I think the way I would interpret that provision is simply that it means you can't, that you can't simply swap this for that. It doesn't, that doesn't make it into a single subject simply because it refers to something else. I mean, it basically says, separates this provision from those provisions and rather than tying them together. So I think I'm okay on that point if everyone else is. the two, a couple of the issues with the, couple of issues with the title, if, I don't know if we want to move on to the title or still talk about single subject, but I did, I'm pretty persuaded, despite glancing at this interesting article, that this really should be referred to as a fee. I mean, I understand the concept that when you're paying money to improve the environment, you're getting something in return. I don't doubt that, but that to me doesn't change it into a fee rather than a tax. This really is something basically imposed to fund a bunch of general related but general services that don't really go back to the person directly. They don't benefit the person paying the tax or fee any more than they benefit everyone else. And so it really does seem like a tax to me, and I think that argument is well taken on the part of the motion that we really should change this to references to tax. I don't know if we want to discuss that, because next I got to get into the science that I kind of made a fool out of myself on last time. Sure.
So another analogy that my colleague was going to make, but I used to do it. All right. Well, the analogy would be to a sewage fee. All right. In certainly the city where I live, we pay a sewage fee that's proportional to the amount of water that we purchase, because the water's measured, the sewage is not. And so it's the same sort of thing. The more carbon dioxide I throw into the atmosphere, the more fee I pay, just as the more sewage I generate, the more fee I pay. We don't call it
right, and
tax.
I appreciate that. That's a good analogy, and except there's a lot more going on here than you know, if your sewage fee went to all kinds of studies about sewage and all sorts of funding a position in the governor's office to consider sewage, then that would be one thing. But basically you're paying for sewer pipes and maintenance and that sort of thing with your sewage fee, is the way I understand it.
Well, in fact, I do pay for flooding and things.
This was part of my testimony. Sam Weaver, also with Clean Energy Progress. That analogy I find to be fairly strong with the sewage fee or dumping fee, anything of that nature, that in the past, there's an evolution of the consciousness around these things. There was a time in our country where you could just go dump things off a cliff, for instance. And it was only when the impact of that externality, if you will, started to degrade the environment for other people that people's consciousness raised and laws were promulgated that then addressed that. And they usually did so with direct fees that were used to fund infrastructure that alleviated the impacts of whatever they were putting this fee on. So in this case, all of these, and I think I understand the point you're making, I'm just going to go a teeny bit further here and say that because what we're doing is changing the chemistry of our atmosphere, it is non-trivial to do direct things that mitigate those impacts, except as we've called them out here, to create these development programs and in some cases direct mitigation such as carbon sequestration or replacement of the things which are doing the emissions. So we've tried to have a strong tie between what we're taking the money for, which is the Pollution Act, and what we're using those funds to do, which is to offset the impacts of those acts on Coloradans by doing programs in Colorado that do that. So I'm the one that put those words in Tom's mouth. I thought I should at least stand up and...
No, and I appreciate it, and I understand completely the theory behind all this is to that when we use electricity, we're not paying for the full cost of it. I completely understand the externality argument, but I don't think that changes whether it's a tax or a fee. And I understand you're trying to tie the costs that we impose to the costs of the fee or the tax that we're being asked to pay, but that too doesn't, to me, make it a fee rather than a tax. What makes something a fee is the benefit is almost the opposite, actually, of that, is that the benefit of what I pay for goes entirely to me. Here, the benefit goes to society as a whole to pay for my externalities, right? That I'm imposing costs on society as a whole, so I'm now being asked to bear the cost of that. And to me, that's a tax, not a fee for a service being provided to me. It's a tax being imposed on me because I'm imposing a cost on society generally. So I appreciate everything you say, and it is really, when you say you're just going a small step forward, maybe it is that small step forward that to me takes you beyond a fee and into the realm of a tax. I don't know. I'm curious about other...
Again, I appreciate that argument. I mean, it's a fine line that you walk with any of these things. In particular, the analogy with the sewage fee still carries a little bit, because the only advantage you get from your sewage fee is the ability to get this stuff out of your house, if you will. You know, it's being able to create it and stick it out there, and then any benefit that you get is simply that. Well, the benefit that you're getting here is electricity into your home. You're directly getting electricity, or you're directly getting heat into your home from the natural gas. So you're paying this fee, which is rationally related to the benefit that you're getting, which is the electricity and the heat that's going into the home. And this fee is then passed into the system to cope with the externalities that you've created. So, you know, it is a matter of perspective. I would argue that if it were a tax, the money would go into the general fund, and the legislature would then allocate that each year and decide where to put the money, whereas we've tried to lay out here the programs that are intended. You could argue that if the legislature guts all of these programs and instead moves that money into the general fund and is no longer rationally related, then it's more of a tax. But as we've put it out and framed it, we have tried very hard to frame it as an analog to a fee. So I won't go on any longer. It's a matter of semantics in a sense. But.
Thank you.
Can I elaborate on that just a little bit? My name is Jerry Todd, also with Clean Energy Progress. And there's a great quote in the opponent's material on page 12. The definition of a fee is a fee charged or imposed on persons or property to defray costs of a particular government service. And in fact, in our proposal, the government service is to mitigate the consequences of climate change, and everybody is a beneficiary of that. There's some people who won't pay for that service, and that, according to our proposal, is those people who have voluntarily subscribed to non-carbon emitting energy sources. And so this clearly does make the distinction. The service is being paid for by those who are creating the problem, those who are emitting carbon, and the beneficiary is go ahead.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but actually that highlights why I think you're why my perspective on a fee versus a tax is different. Those people are still benefiting from these what we're funding, right? If I go out and use all wind energy or something, I'm still receiving the benefit of all these programs that are being funded here.
The distinction is if you're subscribing to wind source, you're not creating the problem.
Right, I understand. So I'm not paying the fee, but I'm getting the benefit of it. I'm getting
you're not getting the benefit of solving somebody else's problem. And this really is highly analogous.
No, but I'm getting the benefit that they're solving their problem benefits me. And that's the whole point, right? Is that we impose, when we use energy, we impose externalities. We impose pollution on others. And so if I'm not imposing any pollution, I'm not paying this tax, but I'm receiving a part of the benefit, and that's why, to me, this is a tax.
Well, the benefit you're receiving is the absence of further diminution of the environment and support systems from the steady state, the natural state. So those who are using carbon are taking us from the status quo, and that's all of us, are taking us from the status quo into a damaging situation. The purpose of the fee is to try to apportion those costs in a very small fee way to try to provide the government with funds to provide this government service, which is dealing with the consequences of climate change. And to me, that is the service the government is providing, and that is perfectly consistent with this applying a fee to the source of the problem to fund the solution. And I'd use this analogy with the single subject rule, for instance. You know, you can wonder, what do painting lines on a pool and hiring an aerobic instructor and painting a bike rack have in common? Well, it seems like those are three different subjects, but in fact, those fit quite concisely under the subject of running a recreation center. And creating a fee to run that recreation center makes perfect sense, and we do it all the time. And what this proposal does is it creates a fee to try to fund government services to solve the problem. And it tries to apportion them as fairly as possible by recognizing that some people contribute less to the problem and they should be charged fees less.
All right. I agree with everything you said. I just think that what that means is that this is a tax because the people paying it are benefiting not just themselves but everyone else, and the people not paying it are also benefiting it. I mean, I think of a fee as like a sewage system. If I don't have a house that runs, that contributes to the city's sewer system, I don't pay the sewer tax, but I don't get any benefit from it either. Or a toll on a toll road. If I don't pay a toll, it's because I'm not using the road. I don't get any benefit from this toll road. Or if I do, it's very indirect. Here, as you said, everyone benefits from this. Under the whole theory of this is we all suffer from when this pollution causes climate change. And so the people, I agree with you, you've tried to calculate the costs in a way that it's based on the people causing the most of the problem. But when I look at whether that is a tax or a fee, the question is, who gets the benefit from it? And we all get the benefit, and that, to me, is the definition of a tax. So I don't know if I understand everybody's position.
I suspect your definition of tax and fees varies from economists who would suggest that a tax goes into the general fund and is distributed for all kinds of purposes that aren't specifically related to the purpose.
No, I don't think that's what it – I mean, that doesn't – change whether something's a tax or a fee if there's discretion on how to use it or not. It has to do with whether when it is used, it's used to give a service directly to the people who pay it, or whether it's used to benefit the state in general. And there are lots of things that are not in the general fund that are taxes. But all these funds we've been talking about all morning are not in the general fund, but they're still taxes because they benefit everyone generally. So I think this is to me is a tax.
Can I just elaborate on exactly your example you brought up of the house that does not generate sewage? Let's say you have some sort of mulching. A toilet, you're not connected to this sewage line, you're not paying the sewage, and I think we'd agree sewage is a fee and not a tax, but in fact you are benefiting from that because if there was no sewer, sewage would be going into the local creek or whatever, and everyone would be suffering from that. So in fact, the people who aren't paying, similarly, direct analogy to those that say have wind source.
Well, then, everything is a fee. I mean, because paying for everything out of the general fund and so having brilliant lawyers working in the Attorney General's office benefits all of us indirectly, right? And so then all the taxes we pay that end up going to fund the Department of Law should be considered fees. I mean, that's the problem, is there's no just because we all indirectly benefit from good government or good government programs doesn't turn funding every program into a fee, does it?
Well, the difference, I think, is that these things are very directly connected through the emission of greenhouse gases. So the fee is on greenhouse gases. The damage is caused by greenhouse gases. The benefit to everyone is caused by mitigating those effects.
I think I'll reserve. I don't know. Maybe I'll jump in here, but I don't know whether it's the right time. I should say, maybe for the benefit of people that are here for the afternoon agenda of the title board, we're still on our last morning agenda item, and I think we're going to, I mean, it looks like we're a little ways off before we finish that agenda item, and when we do, I intend to take a 5 or 10 minute break at least, so it'll be a while before we get to the afternoon agenda items, just to let people know who may be waiting. So, with respect to the discussion that we're having, I'm not sure, frankly, what to make of it. I mean, I agree with Mr. Domenico. I think it's a tax. I mean, in the way that I usually think of fee versus taxes from where I sit in state government, I mean, and yet I'm not quite persuaded that we need to change the titles, because I think the difficulty that we're struggling with is that I think I think there's sort of a middle, at least a common understanding that's doesn't quite have the same bright line that lawyers might have, or maybe economists or others. I don't know. I think this is not a fee in the normal sense. I think that you pay something and get something of value in return, a fee for a driver's license or something. I think of it as not being necessarily the way a tax, the way some people think of it, like income taxes. What's a little different here is, and I'm trying to harmonize some of the discussion here, is that regardless of what you call it, and I'll call it a charge for the time being, it is directly related to the activity. In other words, it's a charge that helps, as I understand it, and there may be some quibbling about what I'm about to say, but it's a charge that helps offset the cost of the activity that's being charged. There is a connection there. Now, I still think that's a tax. Like Mr. Domenico saying, you're not getting the benefit back. You're sort of being, you're offsetting the cost of that, which is probably what I think of as a tax. And yet, I think the average person might not make that distinction in the same way, fee versus tax. And so, personally, I think we've said it in the second word of the title that it's a tax, basically, that we are raising taxes. I actually don't feel strongly about changing it. I think we're okay the way we are. I think we could say charge. I think we could say tax throughout. But it sounds a little misleading whether you say fee or tax, in a way, in my opinion. Neither one is to me exactly captures the fact that this is a charge based on the activity to offset the costs associated or attributable to the activity. And I sort of feel like we're having to, if we pick fee versus tax, we're having to pick one side or the other of the debate. They each come with their own connotations that are a little inaccurate here, maybe. But I don't know where that leads me, but I'm not yet persuaded to change the title, even though I tend to agree with Mr. Domenico in principle. But I don't know, Ms. Eubanks, whether you want to comment on this or not.
I will at whatever point in time you'd like me to, if now's the best time. I think I'm in agreement. The reason that we approve the title as it appears before us now is that we think it's a tax. It doesn't fit the characteristics of a fee in terms of that the cost of this service provided is equated to the amount of fee being charged. I mean, what I equate it to is similar to I get a driver's license, and there's a cost associated with issuing that license, and I pay the cost for that service of getting my license. That, to me, is a fee for service. As the court has defined those particular types of charges, and I think how it's included in the motion for rehearing. I think that also in Bloom versus Fort Collins, it's the same thing. You don't have to have mathematical exactitude in terms of the amount being charged for the service, but there has to be a relationship between the amount being charged and the actual service being provided. When you're dealing with a sewer situation, you're being charged based on the amount of waste produced for transporting and disposing of that waste, and the charge imposed by a municipality or sewer district or whoever, it's related to the cost or that quantity of disposing of the waste. I see this, because you don't have that relationship to the particular cost of the services provided, it's much more generalized in terms of public purposes, in terms of benefits, whether it's, you know, a free rider situation or not. I think that the reason that we set the title the way we did is because we did not think that the charge imposed by the measure, even though the measure calls it a fee, is a fee. It's a tax. Now, in terms of what we call it, I'm somewhat uncomfortable of going through and replacing the reference to fee as we've set in the title. And I go back to a similar provision back, I think it was number 14, that imposed, I believe, sort of a building permit fee that then was to be used to fund higher education capital construction projects. And we followed the same sort of format as we are right now on 83 in terms of it started out, shall state taxes be increased by the imposition of a fee on this for this particular purpose. I feel, as a member of the board, a little uncomfortable changing the terminology that it appears in the measure, but I do agree with Mr. Hobbs that the fact that it starts out with the statement, shall state taxes be increased, it's there because we don't think that it meets the characteristics of a fee, that it is a tax, and that's why we have that language.
Yeah, and I guess I may be persuaded by that idea that even though it's a tax, it's okay in this context to refer to it as a fee, because generally the reason that we're concerned, the times where tax versus fee is a material issue, is when someone's trying to get around the Tabor requirements. And so since they're not doing that here, maybe you're right that it's really just not material to distinguish between a tax and a fee, having already gone along with using the introductory Tabor language. I mean, there is some risk to you, I think, that they'll file in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will say, no, it's misleading to call this a fee. But if you're willing to take that risk, maybe you're right that it's not really material in this context, even though in some cases it's really dispositive. I think maybe we should just leave it. I mean, if you're willing to take that risk, that the Supreme Court would disagree with us on that.
Yes, we are.
Well, we can come back to that, but I want to make sure everybody's had a chance to complete their arguments. And Mr. McKinnon, I sort of lost track of where you are. Did you get through yours?
Yeah, we're done.
Okay. All right, thanks. Yeah, I don't think does anybody else have questions? Mr. Domenico.
I have one question that I asked last time, and in this context, I should note that I talked to my father about this, and first of all, he warned me that I shouldn't go out in public saying he's an atmospheric scientist, even though he has a degree, a PhD in astrophysics, but it's outside of our atmosphere is his expertise, and even though he does work with... He works with all the guys at NCAR and everything. So he spends a lot of time with atmospheric scientists, but he says I should not. He says they would laugh if they heard him being represented as an atmospheric scientist. But with that in mind, I really do think, and I talked to him, and he talked to some of his coworkers who are atmospheric scientists about this. I really do think that it's not just carbon dioxide emissions that are being attacked here, right? It's pollution of all these gases. And unfortunately, what that means is I think we need to change on line 3 carbon dioxide emissions to say something else. Because it really is, if you somehow had a plant that only emitted nitrous oxide or something, and you'd still have to pay this fee, right?
Would not. May I address that?
Yeah.
Overarching question. So there's, let's separate in our minds where we're getting the funds and what we're doing with them. Practically speaking, natural gas and electricity, the only greenhouse gases, natural gas when it's burned and electricity when it's generated, are carbon dioxide. Natural gas, there are leakages of wellheads and whatever there is, methane release, that's another greenhouse gas, but we're talking about burning it. So that captures, I think the number is 77% of Colorado's greenhouse gas emissions, those two. There are four other classes of greenhouse gases, nitrous oxide, methane, sulfur hexafluoride, and so on, that contribute. From a practical matter, they would be very hard to measure. So, for example, the leakage at a natural gas wellhead, you don't have any convenient meter there to measure it. In the EPA's toxic release inventory for other similar things, they just have to make very coarse estimates. You know, a pump packing will leak so much, and they calculate it that way, but that wouldn't be appropriate for collecting this fee. And then what the Clean Energy Progress Fund will do is to promote measures to reduce all six greenhouse gases as defined by the Framework Convention on Climate Change. So as a practical matter, if you did have a power plant that emitted only nitrous oxide, well, I mean, not as a theoretical matter, if you had a plant that only emitted nitrous oxide, yes, you wouldn't pay the fee. As a practical matter, that simply doesn't happen. However, there are agricultural sources that do generate a lot of nitrous oxide, right? So the Clean Energy Progress Fund would then go out, and if that's a big source, which in fact it is, then those some of those funds would be used to reduce nitrous oxide emissions from agricultural fields.
Okay, so I understand that back end. But 3A says a clean energy progress fee shall be imposed on the production of global warming pollution. Global warming pollution is a defined term in 2H, which means the emission of the six heat-trapping gases, which includes all the things we've talked about. So as I read that, I guess maybe what you were just saying is when you consume natural gas and produce electricity, which is what triggers the fee, the only one of those six that's ever emitted in that part of the process is carbon dioxide. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. So it's 3B and 3C that are the operative for collecting the tax.
Well, right, except the way I read it, you're taxed if you emit any of these six things. The way it's calculated is you convert the emission of a ton of nitrous oxide into a carbon dioxide equivalent, and then you multiply that times whatever the $3 per metric ton. And so I'm a little reluctant to rely on the idea that in practice, the only one of these six things that's emitted is carbon dioxide, when the language of the measure itself that'll be on the books would impose this tax on all six of these, the emission of all six of these things. So the problem is I'm reluctant to use in part three what would be the obvious thing to use, which is global warming pollution instead of carbon dioxide emissions, because that's how I read this as actually what the fee is being imposed on is the production of global warming pollution. which is why I'm reluctant to change it. But I'm even more reluctant to say this only taxes carbon dioxide emissions. I mean, and maybe this is the way to resolve this, is to, instead of carbon dioxide on line three, just say certain emissions from the production from well, let's see, a fee imposed on the consumption of electricity or natural gas based on the emission of certain, based on certain emissions, please help.
May I just respond to the practical matter here? I mean, we'll all agree it's only on electricity and it's only on natural gas.
Right.
The only greenhouse gas that's emitted from those two is carbon dioxide. So we're arguing a hypothetical here that simply doesn't happen.
What's the difference then between clean coal and dirty coal? Well, then what is the difference?
Well,
you can sequester the emissions.
So clean, for example, the latest plant that Xcel Energy is building in Pueblo, Comanche 3, is marketed as a clean coal plant, which means they're more aggressively removing oxides of nitrogen, sulfur, and mercury. There are certainly many people, including our former vice president, who says that there is no such thing as clean coal unless the carbon dioxide is also removed.
No, but I understand that. But you just said the difference is what you're sequestering all this other stuff that emits.
Removing sequestration usually is associated with pushing it.
Right, but the difference is some plants emit other stuff besides carbon dioxide and some don't. But is the other stuff is never hydrofluorocarbons
That's
or
correct.
Sulfur hexafluoride?
That's
it's
in
never any of those things? Okay.
Well, sulfur, I mean, most of them, none. The ones that it does are insignificant.
So your intent is, if I'm running a plant and it's discovered that my plant in creating electricity emits somehow hydrofluorocarbons or nitrous oxide, you're saying that just never happens. And
it never happens, and if it did, by this initiative, you would pay no fee on it.
Then why is it written on 3A to say, instead of just saying on the production of carbon dioxide emissions, why does it say imposed on the production of global warming pollution, which pulls in all these other things?
Well, I mean, from a Venn diagram standpoint, the carbon dioxide is inside the larger collection.
Yeah, exactly.
So it means the same thing in a practical matter. You could make an argument that the wording would have been more clear if line 31 had said carbon dioxide instead of global warming pollution. I couldn't argue that, but I also think that the way it's written here is also logically valid as well.
Well, I mean, I guess I just am nervous about a title that says we're imposing a fee on that's based on carbon dioxide emissions when the measure itself says it's based on carbon dioxide emissions and emissions of methane, nitrous oxide, hydrofluorocarbons, perfluorocarbons, and sulfur hexafluoride, even if it's true that those aren't emitted in the production of electricity or burning of natural gas. I don't know if anybody else is concerned at all about that, and I guess I'm willing to go along with the majority, but...
Ms. Eubanks?
Well, I have to agree. I find it somewhat troubling that if carbon dioxide is the only thing that's emitted why it was written the way it was, but what I was going to suggest is you were proposing language is if we decide to go that way in terms of removing the reference to carbon dioxide, one thing that it helps, I think, to most people when you have a reference like carbon dioxide is that you know it's a gas, I mean, in terms of the type of emission. And so what I was going to suggest is as you were proposing your language, maybe you say based on emissions of certain gases, is at least that they know it's airborne rather than a liquid or solid, and maybe technically you don't have an emission of a solid. I don't know. I'm not a scientist. But it just seems like the reference to gas would be helpful to folks knowing in terms of what types of emissions you're talking about. Now, whether or not you want to go further in terms of, you know, the emissions of certain gases resulting from, because then I hate to, you know, the production of electricity and the consumption of natural gas. Just some options that if the board wants to go that way. I agree that it does seem somewhat problematic to have a reference to carbon dioxide when the measure is drafted in such a way that it's referring to the carbon dioxide equivalent, which is based on the six gases. So if we want to play it safe, I don't know that it's incorrect to go the more general reference to emissions of certain gases. The fact that perhaps as a reality some of them will never be emitted through that process, but I don't know that that would be an incorrect.
Yeah, and you know, we're running into the difficulty we had last time of this single subject statement getting really long and complicated, and it sort of seems to me if we're going to do that, maybe we go back to just ending at getting rid of the part in the single subject that refers to based on any kind of emission. And you just sort of in the single subject say concerning a fee imposed on the consumption of electricity or natural gas to be used to reduce certain forms of pollution, and in connection therewith imposing the fee based on the amount of emission of certain gases resulting from natural gas consumption and electricity production. And then you've sort of resolved my problem. Then the measure doesn't have any reference, I don't think, to carbon dioxide, which I'm not sure is a good idea, because it really is the main focus, even if it's not the main problem, only thing.
We would oppose that change because, you know, we think the voters are cognizant of the fact that carbon dioxide is a global warming gas, and if we start stripping it out and replacing it with just certain gases.
How about this? The amount, taking that part out of line 3 that I suggested, and then at the end of line 4 where it says imposing the fee based on the amount of carbon dioxide emissions or its equivalent resulting from or carbon dioxide emissions.
Well, if we're going to add or its equivalent, I would suggest we add that in line 3 after the carbon dioxide.
Yeah, I'd probably switch it around to say something like, if we left it in line 3, based on emissions of carbon dioxide or its equivalent. And it just reads a little bit better that way. But
is it really needed in line 3? I mean,
that's what I think. I'd get rid of it there. You could leave it in line 4,
mm-hmm.
imposing the fee based on the amount of carbon dioxide, the amount of carbon dioxide emissions, or the amount of emissions of carbon dioxide or other specified gases
That's probably what I would do. Mm-hmm. And you have carbon dioxide in there in line 4 rather than line 3. That's still a reference to other gases.
My colleague would like to bring up a point that we do want to include carbon dioxide to make sure that it's apparent that wind source and utility, all the wind things, are not paying the fee because there's carbon dioxide generated.
And wouldn't that be accomplished by what Mr. Domenico is suggesting?
Is the latest language, the answer is yes.
Yeah, my latest suggestion was delete based on carbon dioxide emissions in line 3, leave the reference in line 4 to carbon dioxide, but move emissions to say upon the amount of emissions of carbon dioxide or other specified gases, and then that would be it.
Can I make one comment? I think carbon dioxide equivalent is a term of art that gets used in the IPCC reports and mm-hmm. so on. So one thing that might keep any changes minor would be on line 3 based on carbon dioxide equivalent emissions. Do it the next time carbon dioxide shows up in the next line. And carbon dioxide equivalent, it's understood how to calculate its global warming cross-section.
Right.
How long it stays in the atmosphere, and that gives you a carbon dioxide equivalent, and then people generally talk about things in terms of their carbon dioxide equivalent because carbon dioxide is the main greenhouse gas.
Right.
If I could just comment on that, to me, I don't think carbon dioxide equivalent means anything to most people.
Right.
I mean, obviously, you know, folks that work in that area, it's a term of art, but for the average voter, I don't know that that tells them anything at all, other than what does this mean?
Our preference is to leave it as it is because from a practical matter, it hits 100% of what we're trying to do. I mean, there is absolutely no chance now or in the foreseeable future that electricity generation or natural gas will generate significant amounts of the Framework Convention greenhouse gases.
Well, I like Mr. Domenico's suggestion. I don't know. That's kind of where I am on this. But.
Yeah. It's just not a perfect way to do it. I mean, the other way would be to go back to just getting rid of everything other than saying you're imposing a fee on consumption of electricity or natural gas. But I think we did want to get some of a purpose in there.
If I might offer a comment just so you're factually correct there, the fee is not imposed on all consumption of electricity. And the title needs to be perfectly clear that when we're talking about the consumption of electricity, the fee is only applied to that consumption of electricity that involved the release of carbon dioxide in its production. You all struggled mightily with this a few weeks ago, and it was torturous for everyone, but actually you did quite well there in the beginning in coming up with a clause that's accurate and concise.
That's a valid point, that if I have a wind farm, it doesn't apply to me.
Well, let me suggest we hold that thought just for a little bit. I wanted to hear from Ms. Larson again, and if there's anybody else who wants an opportunity to weigh in on any of the issues raised in the motion for rehearing. Ms. Larson?
I just wanted to revisit the point regarding the question of carbon sequestration. Again, the proponents are attempting to make the conclusion that merely because their intent, they say, is to only have possibly a program or a research completed on the issue, the text of the initiative does not limit the carbon sequestration program to just a demonstration program or to research efforts. And in fact, geologic sequestration is specifically defined within the initiative. It's defined to include sequestration of carbon for more than 1,000 years at a rate of 1,000 feet below the Earth. So it does envision and does anticipate the fact that geologic sequestration is going to be implemented and the manner in which a minimum geologic sequestration program must meet that certain requirement of how far below the Earth it will be stored and for how long. If the proponents wish to limit the sequestration program to just research and development of such, I would have hoped that they would have specified that within the initiative. Unfortunately, they do not. By the manner in which it's proposed here, it will, in fact, result in a regulatory program. If they will be implementing a geologic sequestration program, that will result in emitters of carbon, industries having to install sequestration vehicles in order to capture that carbon and to sequester it. Additionally, with respect to whether or not carbon is in fact a regulated pollutant, it's not. Despite the Supreme Court's standing and decision on that matter, the EPA still has yet to regulate it. It's not yet a regulated pollutant, despite the Supreme Court's decision. And in fact, as attached in our motion, Exhibit A, the letter from the EPA Administrator Johnson, it discusses in some detail the complexities that are faced with attempting to regulate carbon and how that will, in fact, require a great deal of discussion, analysis, in order to see how that will be implemented. And it will affect not only just potentially the transportation sector, but various other sectors and all facets of the economy. With respect to the fact of whether or not the initiative prohibits the General Assembly from further action in the future, the comment was made, well, because this is also included in the tobacco tax amendment, therefore the language as it's provided for in here must be acceptable. As was noted, that was an amendment to the Constitution, and the tobacco tax amendment dealt specifically with tobacco taxes. So the language of that amendment specified taxes regarding tobacco. Within the initiative currently, it's very vague. It's general. It provides that the General Assembly is not allowed to reduce or repeal funding to any program which deals with economic development or job creation. It does not specify just to pertain to programs that deal with the new energy economy. And then just another item to go back to with respect to the title at this point. Without specifying here that this is in fact a tax throughout and leaving the term fee in there, by having that, you're inherently going to have a flawed in the title because there's going to be a conflict at some point for the average voter trying to determine whether or not a fee is being assessed upon them or a tax. And the fact at this point that you don't have set what the rate of the taxation will be, again, leaves doubt within a voter's mind as to what exactly is being assessed upon them. So I request again that the reference to fee back be changed to tax.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else? I think I need to move on to board discussion because we're running pretty far behind, but don't want to cut off anybody, but we just need to have some kind of resolution to the issues that have been brought up.
Well, in addition to the points we've been discussing, I do think it probably should include the amount of the tax, perhaps. I know we don't always include that, but since this is a new B, it might be worth putting in there, partly because I think it helps explain some of the difficulties we've been having about this, what exactly this tax is going to apply to. By including how you calculate it may help clarify what's going to be going on. You know, in line 4 it could say something like imposing the fee at a rate of $3 per metric ton of carbon dioxide or carbon dioxide equivalent emitted to the atmosphere from natural gas consumption and electricity production. That, I think, may help clarify a little bit of the issue with what we're talking about, since that's what actually is going on. That doesn't resolve all of the problems, but if you change 4 to say that, then I still think you could get rid of the potentially misleading part of line 3 and just skip referring to carbon dioxide. Even though I understand the concern that that may confuse some people into thinking that even though they're using all wind or renewable or non-CO2 emitting sources of energy, that they may be stuck with the tax. I think pretty quickly they'd be disabused of that notion by reading any further along, and I'm not sure it's necessary. I do think it's necessary to make that clear in the title. I'm not sure it's necessary to make it clear in the single subject statement is what I'm saying.
So to pursue that idea, would that involve? I mean, this sounds promising to me, but I want to try to flesh that out a little better. In line 3, removing the phrase based on carbon dioxide emissions, and then in line 4, incorporating Mr. Domenico's suggestions, imposing the fee. And I don't know the exact way to do it, but at the rate of $3 per metric ton of carbon dioxide or carbon dioxide equivalent, which I like, emitted, and I don't know whether to pick up the rest of that from the measure, emitted to the atmosphere from electricity generation and natural combustion. And can we can we use that language to replace the first clause after the in connection therewith?
That would be my suggestion.
I think I'm okay with that. Promising. Let's at least take a look at that. And yes, it'll be eliminating that phrase at the beginning of line 3.
So it's a
And I think the other part of that was basically saying carbon dioxide twice. A ton of carbon dioxide or carbon dioxide equivalent. It may not make anybody totally happy, but I think it helps. I think it puts emphasis on the carbon dioxide. It still has the phrase carbon dioxide equivalent, which is not a, which may be a term of art, but I think someone can figure it out. Actually, I think that it's either carbon dioxide or something equivalent to carbon dioxide.
Right. I mean, I think the science, that's not quite the way it's used in the scientific sense of carbon dioxide equivalent, but I do think it accurately conveys how the fee is being imposed, which is what that sentence is talking about. And if in fact these equivalents or other gases are basically immaterial, then if that's not quite accurate, I don't think it would mislead anybody in a way that it would change anybody's vote. So I think that's pretty good.
I'll go ahead and move that change then.
I'll second it.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Any other changes? Ms. Eubanks.
In terms of the argument that pollution is a catchphrase, that if we have that concern up in the statement of single subject, whether or not that could be changed to be to reduce certain gases in the atmosphere.
I'm not troubled by the term pollution. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think if we neutralize it and talk about reducing certain forms of gases in the atmosphere, that seems a little misleading to me. The oxygen, or I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm just
hopefully we can do that. Well, I agree, but also there is a negative connotation mm-hmm. to the word pollution in terms of it's something bad. And people may differ in terms of their opinion of particular gas being pollution or not. So I just wanted to throw that out.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and there is a there is something to the argument about CO2 as a pollutant in the sense that it's a necessary pollutant up to a certain extent. We need a certain amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, right? And so it's just too much is the bad thing. And so there is a little bit of risk that by saying pollution, in addition just to it having a kind of negative connotation as a catchphrase, there is a little bit of something to the idea that it's a bit inaccurate or maybe misleading. I don't know if I'm quite there that I would really say it's misleading as it is, but it may be better to avoid that problem when you combine it with the potential for a challenge based on a catchphrase and say something like to reduce the amount of certain gases in the atmosphere. I mean, that's pretty bland, and but it's unquestionably accurate, and because it's bland, doesn't involve a catchphrase risk. I could go either way, I think, on that.
I guess in terms of for the proponents, are they willing to take that risk?
Yes, we're willing to take the risk. In fact, Ms. Larson, arguing some semantics that are a little disingenuous, I mean, the Supreme Court unequivocally ruled that carbon dioxide is a pollutant. It's not a regulated pollutant because it's working its way through the EPA, but I mean, the highest court in the land has made that statement.
Well, right, but I mean, that's just because the Clean Air Act's definitions. I mean, this is not a tying it to the Clean Air Act, right? I mean, the only reason is I mean, I guess I'm okay with it, but yeah, I guess I'm okay with it.
Okay. Anything else?
I mean, just to bring that up, what I was starting to say is that Congress could change the Clean Air Act to change the definition to exclude carbon dioxide, and then where would we be? I mean, so I think we should sort of try to do it just based on kind of a reasonable everyday use of the word pollution rather than a technical analysis of EPA regulations versus the Clean Air Act definition, and see what a regular person reading that would understand it to mean. I suppose the average person would understand. I just don't know whether the average person would think of CO2 as a form of pollution. So that's my concern. But if everybody else is willing to go with it as is, I guess I am too.
Okay. Well, if there aren't any other motions, then I guess I'll move that the motion for rehearing be granted to the extent that the board has amended the title and denied in all other respects. And I should state for the record that the understanding is the changes that have been made would also be made in the ballot title and submission clause that kind of begins on the bottom of what's shown on the screen right now.
Second that?
That's been moved and seconded. Is there any further discussion? If not, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That concludes action on number 83. The time is 2:02 p.m. I think we really do need a break, and I apologize to the people that are here for our 1 o'clock agenda, but I would say we'll take about a 10-minute break.
Sir? I mean, if you want to come back at 2:15, if you want to grab something down here.
I just have no ability to comprehend. You know,
yeah.
I was reading an article.
I've got a sandwich in my drawer that I'll probably.
Yeah, I'll just run. The lines will be nice and short now. So what time? I wasn't even paying attention.
Oh, I don't know. Shall we say 2:15? Let's try to start
a little bit apart.
All right, I'll be back in a minute.
Mind you, this is just a newspaper. I had no clue as to what they were talking about. You know, it's the same thing here.
Of a bunch of people. Okay. All right, I'll be back.
Okay.
No. Granted, but this is it, right? I
mean, this is it.
Because we said
for us.
Yeah. So this is the title. Yeah, you guys
right.
Are now.
So
short of us, a 3-part challenge.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
You're going to print it out for them or not? That's okay.